Welcome to today's episode of the Daily Friend Show. And as you can see, poor old Nicholas is still in bed with allergies. I think talking is part of the difficult problem. So the three of us hope to make up for the absence of your beloved host. I'm Sara Gonne, and I'd like to welcome Terence Corrigan. Welcome, Terence.
Hi, Sarah, and I'm sure that there are many young ladies out there who are going to be weeping at what is not before their eyes today. But they got Herman.
Herman, how do you take that and welcome?
Well, I'm look, people who are amorously interested in Nick Lorimer will find in me very few of the characteristics. I'm not as hairy. And I'm not as fluent in my voice, isn't that melodious? But other than core differences, I'll try to be the best Nick proxy I could be. I'm like Poulet Marbe essentially.
You don't
Good thought.
really want to be like
Right.
Poulet
Well, there we go. Ooh la la, Herman is a babe. There we go.
Marbe, but oh, yeah, look, yeah.
Okay, well then, Herman, I'm going to turn it over to you. I know we've done Eskom yesterday, but we've been advised and warned that stage six is about to possibly hit us. And the effect of stage six is that you will have 6 hours of no electricity in a day. Although I think most of us have probably already experienced more than 6 hours of no electricity in a day. And the reason I wanted to raise it, other than the fact that, if I remember correctly, Cyril Ramaphosa scooted back from Egypt, I think it was, to attend to this crisis. And more of his attention we'll talk about later. But it was of a moment that meant that stage eight wasn't far away, and that's 12 hours of a day without energy. And then to contemplate what would happen in the event of a complete blackout. So, with that wonderfully cheery stuff in mind, your thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, this is the cumulative arrival point or effect of decades of mismanagement. Goes back to the refusal to build additional capacity in the 90s. One, I think, probably the only thing Thabo Mbeki ever apologized for. The all of the aboves of the last decade. I'm reminded of an interesting a drama that was produced in Britain in the 1980s called A Very British Coup. Herman, I think, would really enjoy that. And basically, the storyline is that a hard left government takes over Britain, and they are sabotaged by the dreadful Americans, who get at them essentially through the power union. And you have rolling blackouts. We are basically living Harry Perkins reality here. Take away the 1980s background. I also remember our president, then deputy president, saying what that he was doing this war room, and in a year's time, this all seemed like a bad dream. Well, here we are. Oh, I don't know. It's almost like it's passé. I remember when this stuff started, and I'm a lot older than Herman, so he may not, and he's not the same parity. And it was like really frightening the first couple of times. Now, oh, 6 hours of that electricity. You live, you learn.
Herman, isn't that in fact part of our problem? Is the one thing South Africans do is adjust to disaster. And if we're looking at a blackout as the final stage, which means nothing, no electricity. I read a couple of instances where it's happened in Argentina for 24 hours, and I do recall it happening in part of the States. I think New York was one of the cities involved where it went down for 2 weeks. And then I read in the same thing that, unlike, nothing matched India, where 400 million people were affected by a blackout. But that is another story for another time. Do we have to go through a blackout for the ANC to say, private sector, come in where you can?
Well, without sounding too cynical, even that might not be enough. But on the India point, there's this one of my favorite little anecdotes from India is that a guy once said, you know, in India we have a small Christian minority of about 250 million. So 400 million people in India is a relative term. But you see, the thing is, I don't think even a blackout would be enough to get us to that point, because the real question here isn't competence. It is a denial of reality, or just an opportunity to suck dry yet another state-owned entity. And I do think it is worth remembering that in 2014, Cyril Ramaphosa was put in charge of that war room that that Terence referred to, and I do think the Daily Maverick is useful in at least this respect, because I quickly want to read from a piece by in the Daily Maverick on the 11th of December 2014. He might not yet be president, but Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa has certainly become the go-to guy for just about everything that goes wrong in the ANC government and even on continental affairs. From mediating the troubles in South Sudan and Lesotho, we all know how well those two worked out, to the fallout in Kasatu, again, staggering success, and even trying to keep Musi Maimane and Julius Malema in check in parliament. And this is where it gets wonderful. Ramaphosa is a super to the rescue. Now, I must say
Who
wrote that?
Rangeli Mamasami, of course.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow. Okay.
But I do think that the problem here is to acknowledge failure at this stage, even if it is a blackout on the scale of several hours for the whole country or even several days, would be to reverse from that point or to start fixing it, would be to acknowledge failure so fundamental that I think many in the ANC would prefer just to be in denial. Then there's also just the problem of skill shortage. A blackout of that nature would require immense turnaround in terms of technical skills. We're really at the nightmare scenario where the system becomes so depraved of power that it cannot start up again, because you need a certain amount of potential capacity somewhere to at least restart the massive generators, and those take actually a lot of power to restart. So you might get to a point where you can't get the kettle boiling again. And to acknowledge at that point what is fundamentally gone wrong will inevitably lead the ANC to say, you know, yes, we broke everything. And I think it was James Mayberg who is fond of saying that the ANC did more damage to ESCOM in a governance capacity than when their active struggle policy was to blow it up.
Apropos of what you've said, I think a couple of months ago, about 70 retired engineers offered their services free of charge to ESCOM, and Andre de Reiter said, well, you know, they're kind of contracts that have to be agreed to, et cetera, et cetera. So the option was not exactly taken up. But surely all bets are off in this regard. And also ESCOM, I mean, de Reiter also said that urgent procurement measures have become so bogged down that you're better off going through the normal procurement process for what you need. Terence, is the government likely at least to let de Reiter march ahead with some powerful new ideas just to desperately get us back on track?
Okay, just to to address the question of would this shake them up? No, I don't think so. I think the ANC is too wedded to its own sense of eternal destiny, and I think that even if somehow the cabinet or the ANC's executive or whatever could agree to it, there are so many placeholders and placemen and sharks feeding at the carcass that I think what you say about de Reiter, okay, so we have new ideas, we want to bring the private sector in, And I think, yeah, you know, I don't put it beyond the ken of the government to approve that. But there will, as I say, the parasitic interests that are likely to sort of jump on the execution. So yes, of course, you know, we want the private sector to pour power into the grid. Yeah, you know, with the appropriate empowerment measures, and in order to get your environmental impact assessment, please make a phone call to this guy as your prospective business partner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that political power has become such a traded commodity, as we saw through the Zondo Commission, that it will not be given up even in the face of that sort of disaster.
And I think, if I might just add there, the problem also here is multifaceted. If by some magic we get the ANC to divorce itself from its ideology of state control, then the miracle sequence continues and we get the ANC to divorce itself from its sense of destiny. Then we get the ANC to accept policy that there's a private sector solution. The problem there is that then the left hand must know what the far left hand is doing, in the sense that Gwede Mantashe, as far as I can understand it, has already done significant amounts of damage to getting an independent power provision policy actually implemented, even though Cabinet in March 2021 approved that policy. We are now even a year later, in the economic strains and stresses that we are, with Eskom being one of the key caps of economic activity and growth, we are in a situation where the minister responsible for solving this problem can sort of ignore the will of cabinet, can ignore the policy of the president, and not lose his position. It really is spectacular that even at this late stage, whatever his reasons, that a minister can be so fundamentally destructive to a government policy, even if that policy is ill thought through, but at least has some good intentions. Where at this stage, I think the early negotiations of having 5 or 8 possible IPP bidders in Mpumalanga, that's not near enough to solve the problems that we face as a country. So even if we get to that point where, you know, tick, they abandon ideology, tick, they abandon their sense of control, tick, the president signs off on it, tick, the cabinet signs off on it, you still have the problem of just government incompetence and disunity, where someone like Mantashe can just be an absolute roadblock.
Well, Herman, I have to congratulate you to be probably the only person who does understand Gwede Mantashe. And that being said, I think we're really segueing to the next topic. And as my grandmother would say, going from the sublime to the core blimey, she was a Cockney. There are two items that have appeared today that really sort of link to each other, and I open it to you gentlemen to interpret it. The one is that the ANC, the good worthies of the ANC, feel that we must really strive for economic transformation. I mean, serious economic transformation. It must now be upped even further than it has been. And in the same article, they talk about the fact that the Freedom Charter, which they celebrated the 67th birthday of, is as relevant as before. Now, other than both those statements being profoundly wrong, added to that, which Terence picked up, was President Ramaphosa's letter from the president's desk, which basically says that having come, and I do paraphrase, I'll let you at it, that having come through the disasters of COVID and state capture, we must really renew ourselves. We are resilient, and except no one is mentioned, least of all him and his role in that. Herman, where do you take this? I mean, it's a beautiful flow on.
Yeah, no. So part of the problem is that the Freedom Charter, I think, is a historical curiosity, and it played its role, but it contains no solutions for government, and I think in the idea that South Africa shall belong the wealth shall belong to all who live in it, and that the wealth of South Africa, what's the exact line? I have it here somewhere open in front of me. The people shall share in the country's wealth. Well, let's have wealth to share first. I mean, it really is. There's space, and I think the Nordic economic model shows it. There's space for redistribution through aggressive taxation. But what the Nordic model at least acknowledges is that you need a largely free economy. Businesses must be able to operate in the way they see fit. Employers must have some leverage and ensure productivity. And the market should address most of these concerns, because then it gives rise to a tax base that you can actually tax. And if we get to that point, would it be my ideal economy? No, but it would be significantly better than today, than we have today. So that the Freedom Charter fundamentally assumes that there is something like inherent wealth. What it misses, and what I think Cassata misses, what the Eskom strikers miss, and what the ANC clearly miss, is that wealth depends on productivity and the ability to actually make either a product, a market, or a commercial investment attractive, so that someone thinks it's a problem-solving entity or a problem-solving activity. If we want to go the route of the Freedom Charter, my goodness, let's first create wealth. Then we can look at redistribution. But also the idea that the ANC calls on South Africans to intensify economic transformation struggle. Well, the sneaky thing that I think they do is that we are intensifying that. It's just transformation in the direction of mass poverty. So it's radical, it's economic, and it's a transformation. It's just not in the direction that we wanted. By no measurement is Black South Africa or South Africa as a whole better off economically today than, say, in 2004. And that is something that needs to be remembered. The ANC actually managed to double the number of Black South Africans in jobs in their first decade in power. But to cling to that legacy no longer justifies any of the modern policies. And the idea that South Africans have a role to play here, when at every opportunity a productive economic participatory role for most South Africans have been denied them through either BEE, the minimum wage, or just pure idiotic policy that kills productivity, I think it's quite galling for the ANC to sort of calling on the South Africans to do the things that they've made it impossible to do, and that is to generate upward socioeconomic mobility.
Terence, my takeaway, actually was discussing it with Herman earlier, of the findings on Cyril Ramaphosa in the Zondo Commission, was that he saw nothing, knew nothing, and did nothing. And there's a, to my mind, there's an element of that reflected in his letter to us peoples. He's basically saying, I'm nowhere to be found. I'm there somewhere, but I'm certainly not at the forefront of making your lives better.
I would encourage everyone to read that letter, because I want you to understand it's not the 1st of April. I'm not making this stuff up. You can't make this stuff up. But he's going on about how we've been through these two enormous traumas, COVID and state capture, and now we are resiliently building up, and there's these dreadful people, dreadful, absolutely dreadful people, who were doing all this really illegal, completely illegal stuff and undermining our institutions. And, it's as big as belief that these people would doing this stuff. Okay.
He just didn't see it happening all around him committee meetings.
Yeah, he was just deputy president of the ANC, deputy president of the country, and sat in on the on those cadre deployment committee meetings. I mean, I'd like to send Chief Justice Zondo a big bottle of Bells. I don't know if he drinks. I don't have his address, so I can't do that. But
I'm sure he does now.
Well, yeah. But I mean, we can be very cynical about committees, and I don't think there's a huge amount there that wasn't known or at least wasn't suspected. But what I think was very impressive is that he said very clearly, this stuff is wrong. You can't do this. And his comments about cadre deployment were absolutely scathing. And he made a very clear, explicit reference to President Ramaphosa saying, to just say that, we don't have minutes for those meetings, and it's okay and whatever. This kind of, yeah, I was kind of there, you know, when it happened, but I'm not really there. And, you know, the food wasn't so great anyway. He said that no, sorry, that doesn't include things. This is a very, very serious matter. So if the esteemed president is serious about this new path and, you know, new, I mean, he was talking about, you know, we were embarking on like opportunity here. There's always an opportunity if you, you know, we opportunists or opportunity takers or however you want to put it. to build this capable state that's ethical and accountable and puts the people first. I mean, it's impressive and it's chutzpah. And I'm not Jewish. I'm Catholic, but yeah, you know, I think, sorry, your people have gifted us with a word that is the translation.
Absolutely, it's free for anyone and all editors.
Yeah, no, but I mean, we were saying earlier, would a mass blackout shake the government or the ANC from its torpor? I don't think so. And I just, you know, I think when you can pen something like this, put it out as a letter to the nation, it says something to my mind that I really have no respect for the people over whom, you know, I hold this power. I'm sorry, you know, it would be better if he, you know, wanted to talk about, you know, the lovely flowers that he just saw in Mpumalanga, now we should protect them or something. This sort of thing really, no, it's insulting.
Mm-hmm. I think David gets it right when he said that he saw nothing, he did nothing, and then he looked shocked and surprised. Yeah. Herman, yes. Sorry, loss of train of thought. So I will just ask you to go. Oh, yes. No, what I wanted to ask was, he has been singly more popular than the ANC for most of the time he's been in office, over 60%. He's now had Farmgate and the Zondo report. Is this likely to dent his esteem sufficiently to actually really have an effect on the electoral outcomes for the ANC in 2024?
No.
Oh, okay. Next topic.
Let me just go out of it. Sorry,
if I was
looking a bit distracted on the bookshelf here behind me, was because I was looking for these two books. Number one, Comrades in Business,
Contradiction
and number two,
in terms.
Architects of Poverty. And if you want to sort of understand what has actually gone wrong in South Africa and why Ramaphosa won't be the savior, you just have to look at these two books to genuinely understand that he was never the savior. Mm. His reputation as a businessman is based on the fact that he was at the right place at the right time, politically connected enough when old South African businesses were desperately hunting for BEE partners. And he was freshly out of politics. So he was the game in town, the let's go there, black face in town that you could then add to your board to give credibility. So that's where his business reputation comes from, ill-earned. Then you have this idea that he was a massive negotiator, spearheading negotiator of the Constitution, which is simply not true. I think someone like Pravin Gordhan had a greater influence on the actual formation and content of the Constitution. Ramaphosa was just a friendly face who wasn't Mbeki and wasn't Mandela. And he was clearly in that position to position himself for the succession battle that he then lost. So his idea that he's a great negotiator is based on historical inaccuracy. The idea that he is a great businessman is based on historical inaccuracy and him benefiting from really, really ill-gotten gains of older apartheid era businesses desperately trying to blackface their way into new South Africa relevance. So will he end up be this knighting shining armor? No, because he never was. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most, I think, two of the most impressive politicians of this era of world history will go down as Zelensky and Ramaphosa, not for their substance, but for the way that they managed to win a PR battle for their own reputation with immense success. Zelensky, whatever one might think of him, his government has treated the Ukrainian war as a PR exercise and won the airwaves. And somehow, Ramaphosa, I'm not sure how, has managed to convince the world and the country that he is this savior and this electoral asset. And despite everything, his reputation and his approval ratings remain high. Now, I haven't seen any of those numbers since Farmgate. That will be really, really interesting. Mm. Is the shine starting to come off of Ramaphosa, judging by the media narrative? Most definitely. But the idea that Ramaphosa is somehow the guy is, I think, probably one of the last hangover remnants of South African strongman politics that goes really all the way back to the idea that a savior, whether it's Botha, Smuts, Malan, de Klerk, Mandela, Mbeki, or Ramaphosa, or Zuma even there, is the guy to save us. It's never, ever been about the guy. It's always been about the policies implemented by the guy. And on that score, Ramaphosa is an absolute disaster.
Yeah. Now, I pride myself in calling him out in 2016 in an article. So I have a lot of professional skin in the game, shall we say. Briefly, we've got about 4 minutes left. I'm going to come to you, Terence. Interesting article about a sports coach in the United States in a Washington school who was successful in the Supreme Court of Appeal, in the appeal court, over the right to essentially conduct a private prayer after a game on a sports field, which is what he had always done. And appears there was no controversy until someone, not critically, pointed this out, and he was banned from doing it. And I think it's particularly important because it's almost indicative of how the Americans view the abortion debate. There's no compromise. It's an all or nothing.
No, look, I think that's completely true. My understanding of American public opinion polling is that most Americans actually have a sort of accommodating view. They don't, you know, on abortion, for instance, they don't like abortion. They personally think it's a moral wrong. They would like some restrictions, but not, you know, not for it to be entirely banned. I think and I would probably trace this back into the sort of 1990s, as far back as that. It goes beyond Trump, beyond Obama. You know, you've had sort of the loudest voices in the room being people that really don't speak for a huge number of their constituents. And I think and in America, the question of public religion, you know, when the country was formed, it was quite unique in debarring itself from having a state church. I mean, that was it's often forgotten. People who talk about how, you know, obsessively religious Americans can be, forget that a country like Britain actually has a state church today. You cannot be a chaplain in the British Army unless you're a Protestant. I mean, you know, stuff like that. But you know, this has been a very, very contested issue, and then you know, you also, I think, as you say, have people defaulting to the extremes. Now, let me say, because I often talk about how things have gone wrong in South Africa, but one thing I think South Africa actually has right, and this was voiced by Ibrahim Rasool, who I imagine has many critics among our viewers and also among the participants of the show, but he once said that in South Africa we accept religion as part of the human experience and as something that has a public role. We do not give it an official role. So, to my mind, and I suppose sitting from my experience as someone who is not an American and has no great skin in the American game, if I saw you know, coach of my child's school having a prayer, I would shrug it off. And if, you know, if we played against the Azadville Muslim Academy and they sort of began their game Allahu Akbar, I would kind of expect that. You know, certainly I think to take this all the way to the highest court in the land, something just seems wrong with that.
Herman, you have exactly 30 seconds, which is a challenge to comment.
Yeah, so I think Terence is quite right, and I didn't often say this, but people can read what Alby Sachs said on this matter. He had a constitutional court judgment that he wrote where he acknowledged the religious and fundamentally Christian nature of many of South Africans' cultural norms, or at least Judeo-Christian. The separation of church and state in America often misunderstood. Many of the early colonies, and in fact, in some of the early states, had deliberate state churches. The idea was that there shouldn't be a federal a church. Maryland was very much Catholic, and you know, a place like Massachusetts, if I remember correctly, was very much Protestant. But I do think this cuts through the whole idea of, you know, words are somehow violent or violence. My right to pray is someone else's right to blaspheme. It is the same right from a secular perspective. And I do think in a country like America, if you can't pray anymore in public, then, and that is seen as enough of a threat to other people, it really is this snowflakeification of the mind that you can't cope with someone praying in public. And I think that's pathetic.
Agreed. And that's all we have time for. And I think we've had a lot to think about in the course of this program. So thank you for joining us. Please read dailyfriend.co.za and go to the IRR website, which is irr.org.za, to find out more about the broader institution. And hopefully the hirsute one will be back tomorrow. Here's wishing him well, and we'll see you then. Thanks.